Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of July. This hour of the program, states are making little or no progress in providing affordable college opportunities or improving college completion rates for their residents. This according to a report from the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, and the findings come as states face massive budget shortfalls that threaten higher education funding, and the U.S. continues to lag behind other advanced nations on measures of higher education performance. Among the findings, affordability, the burden of paying for college, has increased for all families, but it's increased substantially more for low and middle income families. Also, college is more affordable in some states than in other states. High school completion rates in Illinois, 95% of white young adults have a high school credential, compared with 82% of blacks. In Texas, 93% of white young adults have that high school credential, compared with 74% of Hispanics. College attendance varies widely from state to state, and the number of years that it takes for students to get through college is pretty high in some states. This hour of the program, we have as our guest David Brenneman. David is a university professor who served as director of the public policy program at the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy, University of Virginia, dean of the Curry School of Education. He was also visiting professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where he taught graduate courses on the economics and the financing of higher education. He conducted research as a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution for a book, Liberal Arts Colleges, Thriving, Surviving, or Endangered. And from 83 to 89, he served as president of Kalamazoo College, and before that, a senior fellow at Brookings. We'll be welcoming phone calls on this important topic. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. David Brenneman, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you.
So we're looking at this report at a time, as you say, when we've got all kinds of economic problems. We have a financial credit crisis, bank failings. As the country lurches toward recession, you say most state and local budgets are in serious deficit. Families are having problems. So, of course, education would have problems, but we darn well better do something about it.
Yeah, and in fact, I wrote those words back toward the end of last year.
Yeah.
6 months ago or more. And, of course, things I was saying lurching toward recession, we hadn't fully announced that we were in one yet at that point. But, of course, we now know we're in the worst situation since the 30s.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what the report does. You measure all kinds of things, don't you?
Yes, this is the best way to describe this in a nutshell is it's a benchmarking exercise. We've done five of these reports, with the first one being in 2000. And we simply set out to determine what what was the best performance of a given among the 50 states, a realized actual performance, not a goal that we picked out of the sky, but somebody did this, somebody achieved this, made this achievement. And we looked in six categories: preparation, which is really an assessment of how ready young people are in a state for college, college's readiness, access, affordability, completion. Then we looked at external benefits, benefits to the state of having an educated population measured in a variety of ways. And then finally, and somewhat controversially, we decided, being a report card, we should measure learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that has, we gave every state an incomplete on that in the early days, and there's been a modest amount of effort improvement made in that regard, but that's been set there more as an aspirational goal, I guess, than anything we could currently measure.
Yeah, it would be hard to measure learning. How do you go about doing that?
Well, there have been some serious, there are a number of groups. This has now become a central part of the accreditation process. It's all part of the assessment effort. People, the kinds of criticisms one was hearing, you know, from business people and others is that we have, you know, hired somebody who's a college graduate and the person can't write a decent business letter. And that would appear to be, you know, to the extent that isn't an exaggeration, that would appear to be something we should be concerned about. So there are a number of instruments that are being developed and actually used to try to assess college level learning, but it's still it'll be a long slog before that is ever done universally.
Mm-hmm. In terms of preparation, how do you go about assessing that? And did you find great disparities among racial groups, among city suburban schools, private public schools? What did you look at?
Well, the data one other point I guess about this effort, we for the most part did not do original data collection. We decided we would work exclusively with data collected by others, and it had to be data that was available at the state level. This is not a report card that evaluates individual schools or colleges. It's not like the U.S. News and World Report or some of the other efforts. This is a state report card. So on the preparation topic, we had each of these large categories has a series of indicators underlying them, and in this case, we looked at high school completion. We looked at information on K-12 course taking, how many students were taking mathematics courses, algebra in the eighth grade, science courses, and then we looked at a series of achievement scores in math and science proficiency. I think we used the NAEP. I believe we used the National Assessment of Educational Progress scores and some of the AP exams, how many high schools are offering AP coursework. And we were finally able to get a modest measure of teacher quality in there. So there are about eight or nine indicators of preparation that underlie this, and we take those and weight them, and then build a composite measure called preparation.
Mm-hmm. And what are the statistics now, David, when it comes to the number, the percentage of young people, the percentage of white people, the percentage of blacks, the percentage of Hispanics who are going to college?
Well, it's fortunate we were somewhat limited in our first four reports on our ability to go into the racial and ethnic data in great detail. Many of the, some of the things like the census reports coming out, every 10 years would give us a national measure, but not sometimes the state measures. But the Census Bureau recently started a new series called the American Community Survey, which replaces an older survey they did. I forget the name of it now. It's the one that we all use, though, but that was a sample survey. The old one was only based on a relatively small number of cases. So when you got down to details at the state level, you just had too small a number to generalize. But this American Community Survey is a much larger sample. And so we were able, for the first time in this report card, to report a considerable amount of racial and ethnic data. And as you point out, the general picture is one of whites and Asians generally doing considerably better at all of the measures we're looking at, and African Americans and Latinos or Hispanics doing somewhat poorer.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of money, I think this is one of the startling statistics here, and it seems a little bit wrong to me. The share of family income, even after student financial aid needed to pay for college expenses at public four-year institutions, has increased from 20% to 30%, but it falls the burden mostly on poor and working-class families who have to devote 44% of their income to pay for net college costs.
Let's see. You have the page reference. Is that on page 9 that you're looking at? Just so I...
it's on the state news summary for Wisconsin.
Oh, I see. Well, what we have tried to do, and the affordability measure, as you know, we've virtually failed every state in the nation on that measure this last time around. We have done. There's. It turns out, measuring affordability is not something that is universally understood or that there's a common way to do it. What we insisted upon doing was dividing families in each state up into quintiles, you know, lowest 20% to the highest 20% by the median income in each group. And then we used national data that we could get to figure out how much, you know, things like Pell Grants, need-based grants, students would be likely to get. And we offset that against the cost of college for those students. We included room and board. Tuition, room, and board were the costs that we measured. We offset with grant aid. We did not we considered loans not to be grant aid. I mean, that's an obligation the student has.
Right.
It may help them finance the education. It doesn't help them pay for it, if you will. And then we related this against the average college cost, private four-year, public four-year, and two-year public, and just looked at the percentage of the income of each of the quintiles that would be required to cover after aid the tuition and fees and room and board. And many colleges, when they do this, they tend to, they'll compare themselves with other colleges. They'll say, well, we're less than, you know, University of Virginia charges more than University of North Carolina. And you know, the affordability is all sort of run in terms of prices and comparisons across states, which have a purpose. I mean, that's nothing wrong with that. But we were really trying to say this is a function of, you know, ultimately of family income. Don't try to get away from that. And so that's where our grades have come out, you know, so negative for the lower income and middle income folks.
Mm-hmm. When you look overall at the state of Wisconsin, we do well in certain regards. In terms of affordability, the study gives this state an F,
yeah,
which is terrible. In other areas, we're okay. Completion, we do the best.
Yeah, Wisconsin has a wonderful history of you know, superb public higher education and some excellent private colleges. I think on the affordability, I mean, we just, our methodology says, you know, essentially gives an F to virtually every state but California, which is salvaged only by its relatively low two-year college tuition. As one of the charts in the report indicates, the stunning increase of college tuition and fees from the early 80s to recent times, you know, up 439% from 1982-84. Ooh. That just swamps every other category of cost. Medium family income went up 147%. The CPI went up 106%. Even medical care, which we all, you know, worry about a lot, went up 250%. So now, you know, tuition fees are going up for a lot of complicated reasons, and one of them, of course, being the fact that state appropriations have generally been scaled back for many, many states, in some cases fairly sharply, because we're the one major public service that has alternative revenue sources.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think about it, people aren't dying to pay fees to be in jail, and we are committed to free public K-12 education and Medicaid. Medicaid expenditures are not matched with family contributions, but higher education has got this alternative, which is to raise tuition, and the states have obviously cottoned onto that, and they're pressing those kinds of increases. They will cut higher education disproportionately in bad times relative to other public services.
Mm-hmm. So are we looking, does the report show that because of the affordability issue, we're seeing more and more people in college who are in the top income group because they can afford to go?
Yeah, there's a little 2x2 sort of matrix you can do of where you compare students on academic ability and preparation versus income, and the very gross simplification of it is that a wealthy, not terribly talented young person has a higher chance of being in college than a highly talented, low-income person. I mean, we really are, things really do scale by income. Of course, the unfortunate thing is if you correlate income, family income, with all sorts of academic measures of preparation, the correlation is almost perfect. SAT scores rise with family income. High school grades rise with family income. You know, often the quality of high schools attended goes up with family income. So you've got all this complicated interaction effect where, you know, you could say that, you can blame a lot of it on poor preparation, but that preparation indexes to income as well. So it's an unfortunate. See, now a lot of universities, I don't know if University of Wisconsin and Madison is doing this, but certainly UVA and North Carolina and others are. We're guaranteeing virtually a free ride to any very low income student who gets admitted to the university, and it's a wonderful program. But the fact is, relatively few low income students, poorly prepared low income students, can get admitted to the university. So the numbers that we're actually supporting in this way are still awfully small, but it is a guarantee for the very most talented youngsters who manage somehow to overcome the obstacles of a low income situation. Many public universities now are really trying to throw out a safety net to that group of youngsters.
Mm-hmm. Joining us this hour is Professor David Brenneman, Newton and Rita Myers Professor in Economics of Education at the Curry School of Education, University of Virginia, and chair of the study that we're talking about, Measuring Up 2008 National Advisory Group. Their report looked at a number of different areas here. It looked at preparation for college, access to college affordability, completion rates, and harder to assess how much learning took place. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to talk about baseball and memorable moments in baseball. Maureen Mullen, a freelance writer who covers the Boston Red Sox and Major League Baseball, author of Yogi Was Up With Guy on Third, Hall of Famers Recall Their Favorite Baseball Games, will be one of our guests. And Michael Bauman will also join us, and he is the national columnist for MLB.com. So it's baseball after 10 today. For you to join our conversation about higher education, Measuring Up 2008, which grades all 50 states and 6 overalls areas of higher education performance. And I should tell you what our grades are. In Wisconsin, we get a B for preparation, or we get a C+ for participation, affordability an F, completion an A-, benefits a C, and the amount of learning incomplete, as it is with most states. As the phone calls come in, we'll continue our conversation and start taking your calls in just one moment. Professor, I'm interested, I don't know how we figure this out, but when you look at what states are dealing with right now and how many have really, really been struggling, when it comes to higher education, I know that the report says that what states can do is allow tuition to rise dramatically, or you say they can establish state policies for tuition and financial aid that balance the financial burden among the state, the institutions of higher education, and students and families. How difficult is it to do that? Are states on that road, or are they far from it?
Well, unfortunately, there are a few good examples, but the what we have found is that, one broad policy for affordability, of course, has historically been low tuition, which has the benefit of course, being clear and transparent and understandable, but it has the downside of giving substantial benefits to individuals at all income levels. So some have argued that more of the wealthier students and families should bear a higher share of the cost. Now, that model has translated itself in the last 25 or 30 years into heavy reliance on individually targeted student aid, and the federal government, of course, led that charge with what have become Pell Grants, which are an income-tested form of direct grant aid to students, which top out at a fairly, you know, modest income level. Guaranteed student loans have also been income-tested for the subsidies. In other words, the subsidized loans were limited to people from fairly modest means. The states, in many ways, got very captivated in the early 90s with the it started in Georgia, what is called the Georgia Hope Scholarship. And these were basically merit-based, non-need-based forms of state aid to students based on, you know, having a B average or better. And in Georgia, if you have a B average or better in high school and go to a public four-year college in Georgia, you basically get all your tuition and fees covered. And this disproportionately went to higher-income families, and it also caused some students who might have gone out of state to a private institution to stay in state and go to, say, the University of Georgia, which was part of the motivation behind it. Now, a number of states hopped on that bandwagon, and so there are 15 or 16 states in the country that are not basically giving need-based aid; they're giving merit-based aid, and institutions with their own funds tend to do that as well. So the states and the institutions often are not helping the problem out very well. They're not following the federal lead.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Margaret from Mount Horeb. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, thank you for taking my call this morning. I have returned to school. I'm 50. I returned to school in response to a layoff. And found that most of the scholarships, the private scholarships, are aimed at people coming out of high school mm-hmm. or a certain age group, and also found that some of the public money also, as you progress in school, gets smaller and smaller and basically leaves you high and dry when your debt from loans is the highest and you really get into a situation of point of no return. You either have to make it through somehow or you're never going to be able to pay back what you've put in. And I've never understood that.
Well, you're putting your finger on a real sore spot in this country, or a blind spot, if you will. I think we've done generally a very poor job of focusing on older students in a variety of ways, not only the pricing, but also when we offer courses, the convenience, the opportunity to attend part-time, to have courses on a schedule and a routine that fits with the needs of an adult married often with family and so forth. And you're right, a lot of the financial aid doesn't translate easily to somebody who's taking a part-time course load. And I'm not sure there's that much direct age discrimination, and there probably are in some of the grants. But
in the private scholarships.
Yeah, I imagine that's true. And I guess there's nothing, I mean, that's to the extent that it's donor-driven, there's not much one can directly do about that. But I think this is one of the reasons, oddly enough, that the failure of our traditional institutions, nonprofit institutions, to meet the needs of adults, I think, has left a very large market opportunity to for-profit institutions, which manage to keep their prices down to some degree. Now, they aren't cheap, but they offer courses on, you know, on a convenience schedule, and they've really gone after the adult market. And even in the midst of this recession, where a lot of companies are doing very poorly, the for-profit institutions are thriving. I mean, they're drawing in lots of students who.
And I have been lucky to be part of a nights and weekends program. So, and it was a new program, and I think you're right; it's addressing that specific need.
Yeah, no, it's a. There's no question. I mean, one of the things that in this Measuring Up report we do try to measure adult participation rates. And one of the things that has been notable in the last decade is that in many states those rates have actually dropped, which is exactly what you don't want. We need all the trained talent we can get, regardless of age.
Thank you, Margaret, for your call. Katie from Madison. Hi.
Hi. This is a slightly different point of view than the last caller, but you had run through a whole list of factors that your guests had looked at in terms of student success, including things like student preparation for college and family income and ethnicity and the quality of the teachers. I wondered, I didn't hear him mention, was there any effort, and I know it would be hard to measure, but was there any effort to look at parental attitudes towards the advantages of having an education? Because so often in the public school, the K-12 system, the effort that a student puts forward and their attitude towards the educational opportunities they have free from grades K through 12 is a reflection of the parents' attitude. Parents' attitudes towards that opportunity.
Yeah, that, we're well aware of that, and in fact, this center that has published this report card has, in another series of reports, has done a set of public national public opinion polling of families, and the striking finding that has come out is that over the years they've done this. The share of families who simply view college as almost essential for a middle class lifestyle has risen to up into the 90% range. So there's pretty clear evidence that parents, and most parents at least, are aware of the need. I think the concern people have is that there's a lot of evidence that youngsters by the eighth and ninth grade are starting to sort themselves out and decide whether college is a realistic opportunity or not. And one of the downsides of our rather complicated financial aid system that we've put in effect is that it's almost impossible for a young person to get a realistic sense of what form of aid, what amount of aid or financing he or she might be able to achieve. And the concern many of us have is because participation has been fairly flat for almost the last quarter century, and there's a concern that a lot of youngsters are just sort of checking out by the ninth and tenth grade and deciding, and then they start not taking the courses they need. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and it snowballs until they simply, by the time they're, if they do graduate, we still have a ridiculously high proportion of young people who don't graduate high school, but when they do graduate, many of them haven't prepared for college. So it's a very, you know, as with all things in education, this is a very complicated matter that involves not just what the institutions and financing can do, but also what families' attitudes. But we were not able to directly, you know, introduce attitudinal measures into this survey.
And they're checking out because they don't see college as being affordable for them, or
That's what a lot of us worry about. That they're worried about affordability. They're not, you know. In many cases, these are the young people who aren't sure of their own talents, and one of the downsides of having these high tuition rates looking you in the face right from the beginning is that, you know, if you're not that talented and you get in and it doesn't work for you and you drop out, then, you know, particularly if you've had to borrow money,
right,
then you're really in the soup.
A lot of us have said we
need policies that would give people a year or two to just make sure, you know, to try it out. And once they've begun to succeed, then it seems reasonable to have people borrowing more once they know that it's going to be a good investment. This is an investment. I mean, I think it's proper to look at it in investment terms, an investment by society and by the student. And I think it's proper to share the cost. I don't think it ought to be all paid for by one party or the other. But as with all, you know, this is a young population that is facing this very large expense at a very early age with a lot of vulnerability.
Right. Brian from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I want to go back to the speaker's original comments, and he made one point in creating this matrix that a small portion of it was given value to the quality of teachers, albeit it was small. But I guess I would like to know, how can you quantify the quality of a teacher? Then I have a follow-up.
Well, again, this is, let me think, what we were able to get. We didn't have a measure of teacher quality in the first two or three reports, and then there was a I think it was something that may have originated or come through with this No Child Left Behind Act, and we were able to get some information on students being taught by the percentage of students being taught by teachers who have a major in the field they're teaching, and that's a very limited. I mean, don't get me wrong. We're not pleased with the quality of the data in all cases that we were able to use, but we recognize every bit of research indicates the teacher quality is enormously important, and the dilemma is that it's a hard thing to get numbers for. But we at least have, if you're taking math from somebody who's had a math major, we were willing to assume that was better than if you were taking math from somebody who's majored in biology or
right.
English.
Okay, I can understand that. The reason I asked that question was I'm a parent who has had five children go through the public school system, and my gosh, they're all doing exceptionally well. There's no two ways about it.
Right.
But in the number of years that we had children in school, I learned one thing, and that is that there were teachers that were underpaid because they were such quality teachers, and then there were teachers that were overpaid because they just didn't cut the mustard. And it's sad, and I think part of that can be laid right at the feet of unions where they try to treat everybody right, but that's just my opinion.
Well, that gets us off into another complicated topic, but there's no question that the pay and incentive systems in the teaching profession don't line up terribly well with performance.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Brian, for your call. Kathy from Green Bay, hi.
Hi, good morning. I have two comments. I'd like to piggyback on the caller prior to the last one, parents' attitudes. Mm-hmm. A lot of low-income parents, having not gone on to college themselves, do not have the means
right.
to help their children prepare for college. And I wanted to let people know that there is an excellent program that Wisconsin has that, like all other programs, could use greater funding. It's called the Wisconsin Educational Opportunity Program. If you look on the state Wisconsin DPI website, you'll see where there are centers that are provided by this program. And it goes into the middle school and follows the students through high school, identifies low-income students with potential, and encourages them all through the whole process of getting ready to prepare for college, takes them out on field trips, helps them navigate the ACTs, financial aid process. So where the parents can't help their students, this program does, very much a one-on-one, almost a mentoring sort of process quite often. And then the other comment I wanted to make is that in too many areas of the state, Wisconsin's wonderful technical college system is not considered a two-year college, a community college, if you will. And gosh, the tuition at the technical schools in Wisconsin is absolutely affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And you can stay at home. You have many, associate degree programs or, one-year programs even to choose from. And then I know I did my education later in life. I was also 50 when I started my bachelor's degree. I did not realize that you could, take the first 2 years at a technical mm-hmm. institution and then go on and transfer those credits to a four-year institution. So you could do the first 2 years of your education at a greatly reduced cost. I'm currently an admissions officer at Concordia University, Wisconsin's Green Bay mm-hmm. Center, and we accept up to 80 credits, and students here are always just thrilled to find out that the courses that they took or the credits that they took even 5-10 years ago can now be applied towards a bachelor's degree. And I think it's just unfortunate that they have this concept of you have to go away to college, you have
sure.
to pay room and board, and there are other mm-hmm. means to get to that point that are less expensive.
Well, I mean, without commenting on the details of each of your two points, I think they're both absolutely right on, and what they both capture is the dilemma of poor information, people not knowing fully what the options are. This is a market. If you want to, I'm an economist. I tend to think in terms of market behavior. This is a market in which the consumer, if that's what you want to call the student is a consumer of education services, is really often poorly informed, and it's not like buying toothpaste, where you buy one kind. If you don't like it, you swap for another one, and it's a small expense. This is kind of a once in a lifetimer purchase, and it's a very complicated market for this kind of for students and others to maneuver their way through. The counseling, you know, in many of the large high schools, too, is just completely overwhelmed with numbers.
Sure.
So few counselors, you know, they just can't give the youngsters the kind of time it takes. It is these centers you described sound absolutely ideal.
Thank you, Kathy, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the lengthy report from the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education that looked at improving college completion rates, affordable college opportunities, making sure that there is access, preparation for college, all of that. And our guest is Professor David Brenneman. He's a university professor of economics of education at the University of Virginia. He also served as dean of the Curry School of Education at the university and is also a member of the Board of Trustees for Sweetbriar College, visiting professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education. He was also a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he conducted research for liberal arts colleges. This is a book, Thriving, Surviving, or Endangered. More phone calls from you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to remind you that confirmation hearings on Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court begin on Monday, and you can hear a one-hour wrap of the day's events each evening at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. The special will air in place of the first hour of On Point, and there will be coverage of the hearings during Talk of the Nation, too. So that begins on Monday. Second hour of today's program, Baseball Hall of Famers. All right, let's go back to phone calls. And our next caller is Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
In late 2005, I heard about a study that came out from the Pew Center with the support of the cable news network CNN Television. And they seemed to indicate that 49% of baccalaureate degree recipients and 72% of two-year degree recipients didn't have complex literacy. And they define that as being able to understand a newspaper editorial or a credit application. And, it sounds very shocking to me, mm-hmm. you know, that you could get through college and get a four-year degree without mastering complex literacy. I wonder what you think of that study or if you'd heard about it. And, I'm thinking about the implications of it. You know, are we sending too many people to college, people who aren't prepared? You know, and why would that be? And do we give people degrees, you know, because they need to get jobs? Is it kind of a feel-good thing that everyone can get a bachelor's degree and move on to go into the workplace? And then lastly, students must be pretty ill-prepared in the K-12 system if they're leaving college without complex literacy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are all good points. I am familiar with that you study. I think one of the things they used were interpreting bus route guides, which if you've ever tried to do that, you know that can be a pretty tricky maneuver. The findings in that were shocking, I think, and I think it's part of the reason why the National Center and others have been arguing that we need to try to think about some form of assessment of college-level learning that is actually that goes beyond just degrees and grades. This is not widely, you know, viewed with joy by many college faculty who sort of think they do this pretty well themselves. But the fact is that in some instances, obviously, people are slipping through, you know, all the way to a degree without achieving some of the basic skills that you'd like to have, and that's why the best known of these assessments out there is an entity called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which poses real-world problems to students that they have to take and digest a lot of information and write a short memo to pull it together. But these are expensive. There are problems with students not having any particular incentives to take these tests. I mean, why would you give up 3 to 5 hours to do something that doesn't have any effect on your future necessarily, unless the institution requires it? So it's a complicated problem. Whether we're sending too many youngsters to college, I guess my bias on that would be that I wish an earlier caller talked about the technical institutes in Wisconsin, the two-year institutions. I think we may have oversold the value of the four-year college degree relative to other forms of post-high school training and education that I think we don't do as well in as many states as we could. I think technical training, HVAC, you know, the old voc ed, which sure. has fallen into disrepute, is extremely important in this. You know, to be an auto mechanic now, you've got to practically be a computer technician. So I think if we had a somewhat richer menu of opportunities that people found equally valuable in terms of, you know, status and prestige, that would be helpful. How you engineer that, I'm not entirely sure.
Sue from Madison, hi.
Hi, yes, thank you. Kind of pulling together the economics discussion and the adult returning student, non-traditional, and the low income, I wonder if your guest has any findings from his study that kind of is the penalties of success. I was a young mother and wife and went to college, first generation, and ended up after part-time and a long time being quite in debt, but getting quite a good job. At this point, my children are no longer considered part of my household. I'm single, and now I make too much money, and I cannot deduct any of my educational expenses. So I'm now, in after the fact, paying the full cost of my education plus interest, not being able to deduct it from my taxes, and now I can't help my kids go to college and they're getting significant debt. You know, this cycle of generational mm-hmm. poverty that I thought I was helping my family break out of, I wonder if any of the studies have found this.
Well, you know, there's been a back and forth in this whole issue of debt. Let me just focus on that part of your question. The you know, we used to go back 20, 30, 40 years, and the amount of debt that students were having to take on was quite limited. I mean, those were the days when many states had virtually free tuition, and you know, it just wasn't common to borrow. Then the debt business really started increasing, and at various times there have been efforts made to allow interest expenses to be deductible. In fact, you might want to check, because I think in one of the most recent reauthorizations of the Higher Education Act, I think there may be some ability to write off your interest on your student loans against your taxes. There was a period when that wasn't possible. But I think that might have changed. But in any event, we're going to have to learn to, all comes back to the issue of what kind of investment this is, and whether the payoff is such that it warrants going into that kind of debt for it. There are certainly people who borrow too much and lose. I mean, they don't have the income. So another policy that's been proposed is to have repayments contingent on income, so that if you didn't do well, your obligation would slowly be forgiven. And I think there's some movement in that direction right now in the current law as well.
Thank you, Sue, very much for your call. We go to Mike from Appleton next time. Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Boy, I wish I had the previous caller's problem, you know, too much money.
Yeah, that was an odd.
I don't know if this question is for the professor, but I have to ask it. I have a boy who's 15, sophomore in high school. He's exceptionally smart. He's straight A with ease. He's taught himself music. He's the first trumpet in the school band. He is in sports and wrestling, and he's also in the Sea Cadets, which is a special Navy program. And I have no money to be able to send him to college, but he's an exceptional student. He's an exceptional person. The only thing that I can come up with is perhaps maybe the military option would be the best for him as far as financing his college. I've gone to the local high school and spoken with the counselor, but, you know, quite frankly, the information that I get is lacking. Any ideas or suggestions?
Well, if your student, if your son is as accomplished as you describe, I would think that he would, I wouldn't limit his choices to the military option. I think you mean like West Point or Annapolis, places like that?
No, I was thinking more ROTC.
ROTC. Well, that's a perfectly reasonable option, but there is, even though some of us wish there were not quite as much of it out there, there is still an enormous amount of merit-based financial aid that is dispensed by, really, ultimately, by the institutions themselves. In other words, when your son reaches the age of where he would apply, I would urge you to have him apply to several public and private colleges and just see what kind of offers he gets. I mean, under some circumstances, he may well get very, very significant scholarships from the institutions. That's one of the biggest sources of funding we have. The institutions doing it, you know, giving their own funds for this purpose. So I think he would probably have a very substantial chance at getting a very, very reasonable college education if he's as talented as you say.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike. Let's go next to Kay from Milwaukee. Hello, Kay.
Hey, we're in that lower middle class kind of bracket. Both my husband and I went to school, and when we started having kids, we realized that we had to start making choices about where our money went when they were babies so that we could save little by little to help them pay for their education. And I think that sometimes we start thinking about paying for college when our kids get to middle school and high school, instead of looking at little things like $25 savings bonds, making a choice between a new car and what will that that value or that money be for a college education 20 years down the road, or even the monthly cable bill. You know, $100 a month is $1,200 a year, which is $12,000 over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think college education is something that's affordable if we start looking at it much earlier and incrementally instead of this, oh, my gosh, my kids are 15, 16, how do I pay for college education?
Well, another vehicle that is available and that, again, is a product of legislation in the 1990s are these Section 529 college saving plans, which you don't get a tax deduction for contributing to them, although some states give you some write-off of the state tax. But when you invest money in a college plan like that, and then when the earnings are all compounded, if there are earnings, they've been sort of hit hard in the last year or two,
yes,
along with everything else. But if there are earnings, the earnings compound tax-free, and when you pull the money out to use it for college, you know, you don't have to pay tax on it at that point. It you know, if for somebody who's, you know, as you say, when a child is born, you can sort of say 18 years from now, the chances are there will be some sort of education in that child's future that's going to cost. So you have 18 years of advance warning. The issue is families, you know, and this is a great worry that many of the colleges and others have. People, there as important as higher education is, there's has been less willingness to sacrifice for it, I think, in recent years as opposed to maybe earlier in our history. People don't want to give up their vacations and their cable, and they somehow want, you know, someone else to cover the cost when the child gets to college. And it's a balancing act, as with all these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people, though, have as well been downsized. They've lost their jobs. So it makes it difficult for families.
Well, I mean, the events of the last year and a half have really thrown almost all of the aspects of this conversation into a cocked hat in a way, because we're just not right now in a very, you know, very tough environment, and some of the old bromides don't work any longer.
Yes. Professor David Brenneman, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure. I hope it was helpful.
It was. Professor David Brenneman, we want to tell you that the report is available online. So if you just go to measuringup2008.highereducation.org. So that's measuringup2008.highereducation.org, and you'll be able to get an even more complete look at the whole area, the state-by-state analysis, find out where Wisconsin is in this, and then look at the different areas that they examined over quite a few decades, actually. Preparation, access, affordability, completion, external benefits of college education, and harder to measure, but part of this as well is what's everybody learning. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Jolema Noel for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls as well. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with another hour of Thursday morning conversation talking about baseball the next hour of our program, so we should have fun with that. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.